Welcome to the Land Jam Podcast, a semi-friendly discussion between two blokes on watches, cars, and everything in between. Now, here are your hosts, Tommy and Sanjeev.
Welcome to the Land Jam Podcast, episode 58, Relationship Status. It's complicated.
That's right. This episode, we're going to talk complications, Sanj, right?
Oh, I thought you said about us.
We're on the outs. All right? It's not that it's complicated.
I'm shocked, but I'm not surprised.
Yeah, we're going to talk about a bunch of different complications, especially one that I don't think we've ever covered before. So should be an interesting episode. All right. I want to kick off with a brand that's a personal favorite of mine. I think you also kind of like the Zen.
Oh, Zen, yeah, of course. Yes.
Yeah. So there's three new Zen 356 Chronos that have just been released to celebrate basically 25 years in the model. I have the Zen 144, but the 356 was on my radar. So I'm kind of familiar with it. Been around for 25 years, did not realize that. Actually began in 1996 as a Japanese limited edition of 300 pieces. Yeah, it's interesting. It was actually a Japanese LE. It was supposed to be a more refined version of the 256. And then in 1998, the 356 became kind of a permanent member of the collection. I got to imagine if you have the Japanese LE, that's probably worth quite a pretty penny considering it's before the 356 even became the 356 in a way, right?
Right.
Interesting. Yeah. So unlike the 356, the standard one, the new one is dual register, right? So it's 3 and 9 registers. It's not tri-register. Inside is the SW510 movement. It's 15 millimeter thickness, dome crystal, 100 meters water resistant. I have to say from my own experience with the Zen 144, even though 15 sounds pretty thick, Zen has a way of kind of wearing it or designing it to wear thinner than it looks or thinner than it sounds. So I wouldn't be too put off with it. I would try it first before you kind of judge it. What else? So the top crystal is sapphire. It's basically pretty interesting. They cut it from a 5 millimeter thick blank, and then it's domed by milling a definitive shape on 5 different curvatures. Which is a really interesting,
intensive.
Yeah, really interesting production technique. Sounds kind of old school the way they do it, but it's interesting. Yeah, I don't know how else other people do it, but it sounds very analog. I enjoy that. Let's see. There's a limited edition of 500 pieces. That's the matte anthracite dial with the silver subdials. So it's basically like a reverse panda. And then there's two other non-LEs. There's like a Fiume dial in brown and a reverse panda dial. And the non-LE versions can be sold with sapphire or acrylic crystals. The LE is the one I think that comes with sapphire only. And let's see, the classic anniversary, two straps, 2,990 euro. With the regular production variant on the leather strap being 2390, 2600 on rubber, 2615 on bracelet. So obviously there's a bit of a premium for the LE, but I think it's still pretty reasonably ranged for a limited edition German made chronograph. What are your thoughts, Sanj?
It's a very well proportioned watch. Do I miss the tri-register? I'm not so sure. I think going like a bi-compact style makes it a bit cleaner.
Yeah.
And a bit more classier. I'm surprised at the thickness, to be fair, but I wonder how much of it is due to the domed crystal. There's a picture of it on the side, and it does look a bit of a chunkster, but if you notice, the domed crystal does take up a good amount.
Yeah. No, I agree. And I think, like I said, I was shocked the last episode when you mentioned how thick the 144 was, because the 144 wears really kind of thinner than you would think that. Zen usually makes pretty like hefty, thick bracelets, but if you put that on a NATO or put that on any other strap, it actually wears really nice and really kind of smaller than you'd think. So, yeah, like I said, you know, the numbers on the 356 sound thick. I really think you need to just try it on and see what you think before you judge it, especially if you get it off steel, you know?
Yeah. And the one I would pick is the Reverse Panda.
Reverse Panda.
Oh wait, is that what it's called? The Reverse Panda, or no, the Panda version, right? The white with the black registers.
Okay, that's a Panda. Yeah, because pandas have black eyes, Sanj. You should know that.
Yeah, I know. I always mix it up when we talk about watches. Well,
apparently you don't.
Anyways, yeah, the Panda version. That's a very cool looking one.
Yeah. No, I agree. It's very monochromatic. It's very simple, but it's actually really cool. Yeah, I think I would pick that one too, actually, Sanj.
Yeah. So is the classic black dial gone? And is it sticking with just the Fume anthracite?
No, the anthracite is the black with the silver subdials, right? That's the Reverse Panda. That's the LE. Then the non-LE is the Fume dial and the white, the Panda that you like.
Right, but if you go back to the previous iteration of the 356, that was just the black dial, black register.
I think the regular 356 exists. I think this is specifically a 25th anniversary.
Got it. Okay. Edition. Okay.
Yeah. Because the regular one is the 3 sub dial, right? It's the standard one.
So that is still going to go on, it looks like.
Yeah, I don't think that's disappearing.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't get the impression it was. It looks like it's just, this is basically the 25th anniversary celebration.
So like an extension of the 356 series then.
Exactly. So yeah. No, I think it's great. I actually like the traditional 356, the 3 sub dial. I think it's a very attractive, technical looking chronograph. So I don't think you could go wrong in any direction you take it. It reminds me a lot of the IWC 3706. I don't know if you know that.
IWC 3706. Not so sure. Let me see. Ah, yes. Okay. Yes.
It's a Fleeger chronograph. Yeah. It's very similar, you know, at least in my mind's eye, to the regular 356. So
yeah, classic like Flieger looking chronograph style.
3 sub dials. It's stacked on the left, right? It's like right. 6, 9, 12. Yeah. It's a very attractive kind of layout. So yeah, big fan of Zinn, big fan of the brand, big fan of the 356. Yeah. So I think the anniversary editions are really something interesting to take a look at.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's kind of like a watch you can wear in multiple scenarios, you know, like whether it's like a tux or like an everyday work watch or just, you know, something that's sporting.
It's versatile.
So
Sanj, what do you got next here? We've got chronograph ticked off. What do you got?
Now I'm going to talk about a first for this particular line. It's the Longines Hydro Conquest, and now there's a GMT iteration of it.
I see. Oh, okay.
Yeah. So the Hydro Conquest is like their Longines dive watch line, right? Pretty potent dive watches in their lineup, and to me it's like a hit or miss. You either like it or you either don't, just mainly based on the aesthetics on the dial. But given how dive watches are getting GMT complications, it's becoming more of a popular one. I guess Longines has joined the bandwagon.
Yeah, definitely.
Which is not a bad thing per se. I think it's a good combination because, you know, you have the capabilities of a dive watch and the ability to tell a second time zone.
Yeah.
I think it's a great combination. And I recently picked one up similarly myself, is in the form of the Zodiac.
Here we go. So, crowing about his new pickup. All right, Sanj. All right. We'll have to talk
it's
about
a rare it. Occasion.
Well, yeah, there's going to be a full dedicated release on that one, I'm sure. So
it's going to be a 3-hour snooze fest.
Yeah, the Hydro Conquest to me is always kind of a bit of a bulkier watch.
It is a bit of a chunkster. I mean, at least this particular GMT complication, but I'm sure it's with the other Hydro Conquest variants, they're capable. I mean, they go up to 300 meters water resistance. And it doesn't even need, at least it appears, it doesn't even need a helium escape valve.
Yeah, okay. Gotcha.
So it comes in four flavors. The Fratello article that we're referring to focuses on this very eye-catching green. It's like extremely shiny looking when looking at these pics.
Yeah. And it's kind of got like a gold accents on the
bezel. It does. It's got like a gilt on the hour indices.
Yeah.
And it's like a sunburst green. So the variant that I'm talking about is this green dial, green bezel, gilt numerals and indices.
Yeah.
So it is basically a 42 millimeter watch with by 12.9 millimeters of thickness. So a fairly wearable, if slightly on the larger end, when looking at the case size.
Yeah.
But not too thick, given the fact it's got a GMT complication. It's the indices are also creamed as well. So it kind of gives it a little bit of a vintagey look, even though it's a modern.
The interesting thing for me is actually the hour hand, because it almost is almost reminiscent of the Tudor Snowflake hour hand.
Exactly. That I was going to come to, but you beat me to it. Yeah, the hands are pretty interesting. And what is up with that? My opinion, a little bit controversial because of the fact like they took the Tudor and made it a bit squishier, I guess. You know,
it's not at the end of the hand, the diamond, but it's somewhat in the middle of it, but still it is, that's a strange decision. It's almost like you're trying to get it, like copying someone's homework, you know. It's a very interesting. Okay.
Yeah, it's fairly bizarre. And the other one that kind of caught my eye was the bezel. Way the bezel's put together, it kind of reminds me of an Omega Seamaster.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
Or maybe even the Planet Ocean.
I was going to say Planet Ocean. Yeah.
Yeah, it looks very similar to that. Like, I don't know.
You mean the font, right? Like the font and kind of
exactly the font.
Yeah. That's interesting. Okay.
It is pretty interesting. I'm not so sure about that.
As far as GMTs, what is this? Is this a flyer or a caller?
That I don't think is fairly mentioned. It might be a flyer.
No, it is a flyer. Yeah, that's good. Okay.
And also, the other bit that is a bit, let's say, I won't say controversial, but a bit of an afterthought is the GMT, the 24-hour markings are found in the chapter ring or the rehot. And if you notice, at least in the green one, it's like not too legible. It's in shades of green.
Oh, geez. Okay. Yeah, I see what you're saying.
So it's not too easy to tell the second time zone.
Interesting. Yeah, and they don't. So it has a diver's bezel. It doesn't even have a GMT bezel.
Yeah, but I'm okay with that. But at least make the GMT portion more legible, right? Like, yeah. I mean, this is clearly a dive watch first, GMT second. It's not like the Black Bay GMT Pro, right? Where it's more catered towards a GMT than a diver.
Yeah, or the Tudor Black Bay. Yeah, GMT. Yeah, I don't know about this, Sanch. This is kind of schizophrenic, you know?
It's a bit of an interesting kind of watch. So there are four flavors. So we talked about the green. There's also this brown iteration with a little bit of gilt. And then there's the blue dial and the black dial. And the other thing I wanted to talk about is that, so you have the rectangular hour indices, except for the 12 o'clock, which is the inverted triangle, but also the 6 o'clock and 9 o'clock that are like circular, I guess, to differentiate. Okay. Not sure why you want to do that. Because at the 3 o'clock, you have the date complication. So why put on this extra effort? It just doesn't sit.
Yeah, that it just seems like too much going on, you know?
Exactly. Even though it's a fairly clean dial. I mean, there's not much left. I mean, three lines of text and that's it, right? So it's like it's an interesting take on, and that's why I say the Hydra Conquest is like a hit or miss. You either like it or you don't.
Yeah, this is not for me.
Not
to be honest, I don't like the regular Hydra Conquest. Really not that much. It just seems a bit big. And then yeah, this GMT take is I think it's a thumbs down for me.
It is. It's unfortunate. I mean, it, there are those who will like it. I mean, the movement is an ETA-based Longines caliber L844.5, and it's a pretty advanced one because it's got a silicon balance spring, anti-magnetic components, and a 72-hour power reserve. But and you do get quite a bit of the for the watch you get. You know, for example, if you go for the bracelet, it comes with a micro adjustment clasp, which is kind of nice to have. So from a price perspective, it depends. It's like $3,150 for the bracelet or $3,050 for the NATO strap. But you and I won't be making a purchase anytime soon on this.
Yeah, I just find the design a bit off and weird. And yeah, I don't know. I feel for that price, you know, you should go for a Tudor, in all honesty. I don't know why you'd.
Yeah, I think so too. I think the Tudor has a bit more, how should I put it, like... individual design. This seems to be taking bits of other watches.
Yeah, exactly. This is like kind of like a homage. It's weird. It's very weird. All right.
Yeah, it's like the bezel is throwing me off. The more I look at it, I'm like, this is clearly an Omega Speed Seamaster looking bezel.
Yeah, with a Tudor hour hand. Yeah, it's got to go. All right.
All right.
We're done. So we're done there.
We're done.
Next up, I've got another dive watch variation, but instead of going for a GMT, it's a dive watch that's been converted into a chronograph. So this is the Oris Diver 65 Chrono. Sanj, you and I are fans of the Oris Diver 65. Neither of us own one, but we've always
talked about it here and
we
there.
Talk about it. Yeah, because it's such a cool kind of line, and there's so much different variations and you know, little differences between you know, their executions.
Yeah, and it is a watch that has a bit of history. I mean, it harkens back to their skin divers from the 1960s, right? The 65.
There you go. So, yeah, it's in the name. Yeah, and we both like Oris. So this is basically not a new release per se, right? They debuted the Diver 65 Chrono back in 2019. But, you know, that was sized at 43 millimeters and it was 16 millimeters thick. And I think the kind of consensus was this is a bit too big to be comfortable. So
that is a chunkster. Wow, 16 millimeters thick?
That's like literally the third time you've said that word on this podcast.
Thickness is important, Tommy.
That's right. So it got a lot of girth. So, you know, it looks like Oris kind of heard that feedback from the 2019 release and they've downsized it a little bit, right? So they gone from 43 to 40, which is notable, 16 millimeters to 15.6, which I'm not sure you'd really notice, but still, I think the 43 to 40 is a kind of a big deal.
Yes, that is definitely a noticeable drop. That's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. You'll feel that. And the 2019 line, the full size line had this two tone, different kind of executions. For now, the new slim down Diver 65 Chrono is solely monochromatic, black and white. It's a classic legible look. So you know, I feel like it's the safest kind of execution for this kind of relaunch of this watch. So smart of Oris to do. Inside, they've got the Oris 771 movement, which is the Sellita SW510, 48 hours power reserve. And they're selling it for $4,400 on a bracelet and $4,200 on a leather strap. What are your thoughts, Sench?
The only thing a couple of things. So you can either get it in a bracelet or a strap, as you mentioned, but the bracelet has these like faux rivets attached to it, which I don't understand how people do this.
Yes, I agree with you. I find that to be a bit odd. So I mean,
for $4,400, I expect like screw down links. You know, this is an expensive watch. This we're talking about this versus the. I'm going to reference the Tudor, but the Black Bay Chrono. You know.
Yeah, I do find that the price to be a bit aggressive. You know, I don't know whether that makes a lot of sense.
I mean, and then also, yeah, I mean, it is, it's nothing wrong and nothing against Salida, but when you pay $4,400, you expect something a bit catered towards more in-house, you know, like the tutor, they've gone in-house.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I'm of two minds here. It's like, yeah, you're right, right? That's what the market expects. But like, it is kind of silly to like, kind of hang your hat on that too, right? It's like,
it's not too bad. I mean, not it's not a deal breaker for me for sure. But
yeah,
if we go SW510 Salida, like you hope that's at least like chronometer certified, COSC certified, or you up the power reserve, or you know, think you like you crank up these specifications on that movement itself, right?
I'm not exactly sure. It's the Aura 771 is what they're calling it. Yeah, 4 hertz frequency. I mean, it doesn't look like they've done a lot to tune it. I mean, I don't know. You know, I'm of two minds here. I think Salida is perfectly fine.
I'm perfectly fine with having a Salida. It's just that for $4,400, I'm not sure if the price justifies the watch. I mean, like if it was $1,000 cheaper, then okay, now you're getting into like a more attractive price point.
So I mean, basically the Zen 356 has the same exact movement.
True, but look at the price.
$2,390 for leather, right? So
yeah,
you're right. That's $1,000 cheaper. So
more than $1,000, right? I mean, it's the only advantage you get here is a bezel.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's interesting, but yeah, I don't know. I also feel like it's kind of silly because if you're expecting a company to go in house with their movement, they're going to come back and charge even more, you know, for it. So it's
true.
Like,
true.
I don't
know. Yeah, I mean, like I said,
there's no way to win on this, you know. Yeah.
Yeah, it's not like I said, it's nothing against having a Salida movement, right? But like you need to justify the price versus like something like what we just talked about, the Zen 356.
I agree. And Zen has always been tool watch first and like very practical, and you know, that's a credit to them. So
yeah. But aesthetically speaking, this is a very good looking watch. Even in just plain black and white. Yeah.
It's very attractive. It's the Aorus Diver 65, just basically beefed up, which I love.
The way the dome goes against the case, like it's very subtle. Like the case is pretty straightforward, but it just works well with the rust.
It's well executed. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a well proportioned, well executed.
There's no complaints on visuals on this watch. So basically, if you get a good deal on it, jump on it because it's a beautiful release.
The gray market. At
full price, you know, maybe think a little bit.
Maybe you look on it in one of your 20 screens on eBay, you know, at your home.
My new phrase is I'm going to pray on it, right? So that's
you're going to pray on it. Depending what the situation is, you know, like pray the hunter or pray religiously. It could be both.
EY or AY. That's right.
Yeah.
All right, Cinch. I think that's as much as we have to say on this release.
All right, Tommy. So it's my turn, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I am going to be talking about your most favorite brand in the whole wide world.
It's got to be Seiko, right?
It's definitely Seiko. And they released a new version of the Alpinist, but this is a very unique Alpinist. This one is the first ever Alpinist with a mechanical GMT complication.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. Okay. Yeah. I saw this drop the other day.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's not the first time Seiko dropped a GMT into the Alpinist. They did this way back in 2003. However, that was in quartz.
2003. Wow. Okay.
Yeah, it was a quartz iteration. And I think even it had a perpetual calendar and even introduced titanium. And you know, back in the day, there were three models, the SBC J19, the 21, and the 31. And there was some 500-piece super limited edition. But this one is becoming a bit more mainstream. And it's coming in two flavors. So, like I said, it's coming in a GMT complication, and it's a mechanical one. Seiko seems to be dropping their GMT complications in almost all their like popular lines here.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So you have the SBB 377, which has the applied indices. So this is the blue dial.
Blue dial, applied indices. Yeah. Got it.
Yeah. So the 12, 3, 6, and 9, it's a very unique type of, let's say, hour markers where they're kind of shiny, kind of mimicking.
A mirror shine to them.
Yeah. Like kind of like the, I mean, it's not a true one-to-one comparison, but I guess it's in a way because it's kind of the same theme, the Rolex Explorer, you know, the 369. I think maybe even the inverted triangle or the, I don't know what they have at the 12 at the top of my head, but those are shiny as well. I think most recently they converted those into having like a lume on it too. But yeah, okay, and you have...
You mean the Explorer 1, right? Just to be clear.
Yes, the Explorer 1.
Got it. Okay.
And I think even the Air King, maybe it was the Air King, because the Explorer 1 always had a lume to it. This particular Alpinist, the SBP 377, does not have lume at the 12369. I think the Rolex Air King, the previous iteration, was all shiny. But that was a bit of a unique type of watch and a big... bit of an awkward watch, in my opinion.
Clear, there is lume on the dial. They have lume pips for each 5-minute marker, right? So there's
they do, but not the applied numerals.
Got it. Okay, got it.
But if you want lume on the applied numerals, I think you'll have to go for the black dial, which is the SBB 379. It's kind of like a.
That's not applied numerals though. That is printed, right?
Yeah, it's more printed, and I'm not sure if it's fully lumed. But that would be my pick, to be honest with you. I think I'm not a big fan of the shiny 12369. And the
I'd go for that. I'd go for the shine. Get a little pop in your life, man. A little depth. Come on.
Actually, you know, if that was printed on the blue dial, I would go for the blue dial. I mean, because I always had a hit or miss reaction to the Alpinist. A lot of them I'm generally not a big fan of, but there were like a couple of iterations. If you recall, there was the Hodinkee special. It was like a blue dial. Oh, and that one was a very good take on the Alpinist.
I vaguely remember that. Yeah. There was a rock face European one. Remember that one? It was like a rock texture dial. I thought that looked really cool. This was like
that doesn't ring a bell to me either.
Like a year or two ago it came out. Interesting.
Yeah, we brought up
the Rolex Explorer, because the Rolex Explorer is also a mountaineering watch that has a GMT capability. So it's almost like this is the Seiko Explorer, you know?
Well, are you talking about the Explorer 2?
Explorer 2, sorry. Yes. Okay, I see. Gotcha. Yes.
Yeah. Technically, I mean, if you really want to be like nerdy about it, like, right, the Explorer 2 was more for like, isn't it like for like cave diving or cave exploration?
Yeah, well, when do you cross a time zone doing that? I mean, maybe it doesn't make any sense either.
Maybe you're digging a tunnel. Who knows?
Yeah, that doesn't really make any sense either. But yeah, I mean, I think it's similar in that, like,
it's similar. Yeah,
it's
I
an
agree.
Active mountaineering watch. It's got a GMT complication, so it's like, you know, they're the interesting thing to me is that they last tried this in 2003, putting a GMT complication in an Alpinist. They took 20 years. To revisit that idea. I think that's crazy, but
yeah. I was going to say prior to that, like, you referenced an Alpinist that you liked and I referenced an Alpinist that I liked, and like both of us don't remember what the other Alpinist you're talking about.
No, I remember the Hodinkee Alpinist. Yeah,
I don't remember the rock face one at all.
Yeah, it had like blue printing for the numerals, if memory serves me right, and the markers. But it had like a rock face style. I'll send it to you after. Don't worry about it.
Yeah. Let's move on.
It's not worth the effort right now.
And the other cool thing is they also have, I mean, so what makes it GMT? So they have a third hand, which is a red GMT hand, like kind of like a red red bordered arrow, and I believe it's loomed as well. And the bezel has a 24-hour marker indication, so you can really track a second time zone. And the other cool thing is, just like the Alpinist, there's like the chapter ring, which kind of within the dial, like the Rehot, and you can adjust it to for like navigation. So it has like a north, south, east, west sort of tracking with like a compass.
That was always with the Alpinist, right? That
I believe
was
so, yeah.
Standard thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Who
uses that thing? But yeah, sure.
It's kind of cool. It gives it a, you know, unique selling point of the watch.
It's something.
There's also a date complication as well.
You mentioned, wait, where's the date window on this?
At 4:30.
Okay, got it.
And the cool thing is Seiko took the extra effort to make it the same color as the dial, at least the background. So
is the blue matching blue? Is that true?
I believe so. I mean, looking at the pictures, so we're referencing a Portello article here, and I believe the blue is matching the blue with the white numeral.
Okay. It's so close to black, I can't really tell, but I'll take your word for it.
That looks blue to me. I mean,
yeah. Okay. All right. Well,
unless, you know, one of us is colorblind here, which is also possible.
Could be me.
Me too, you know. So it's a great piece, timepiece, and it's well priced. I mean, it's €1,200. You get a lot of bang for your buck.
Not bad for a high-end alpinist. Now the question is, you know, we've been doing this show for years now, and we've been through multiple alpinist releases, and we always say the same thing: the cathedral hands bother me.
Yes, they. Oh, yeah.
Is this? It's like 6 years. You could rewind and listen to the same thing. Now, as far as this watch, is having a GMT complication overcome that for you?
I think I can live with the cathedral. The other bit I actually like with this one, so with the other alpinists, if they had the numerals, I think it was like every 4 hours. I think it was like 2, 4, 8, and 10, I think, in the original alpinist. And they were not like aligned. They were like concentrically oriented.
Yes. They were like this radial.
This one is like a classic design, and I really like that a lot.
Okay.
Yeah,
that's one thing actually that I didn't notice, but that makes a world of difference, is that the previous design was more radial. Exactly. Meaning the digits were angled like, from the middle out, versus here is everything is looking basically flat, or, you know, straight up one orientation, you know.
Yeah, and it's also got the 6R54, and it's got 72 hours of power reserve, which is plenty.
Impressive, yeah.
So, yeah, no, this is a good deal in my opinion. I mean, the case is nicely sized at 39.5.
That's a tasteful size. I like it.
Yeah, I think 40 to me is the sweet spot, like 40 or very close to 40, whether it's like 38 to 42.
I do think that a lot of brands are kind of going that direction, like that Longines, Hodinkee, Zulu Time release. Like, they intentionally sized the Zulu Time down to 39, right? If memory serves me right. So it seems like the people in the know to go a bit smaller. So you're not the only one, you know.
So one more thing, Tommy. What do you think about the back of the watch? I know you're not a big fan of the exhibition case back, but I think, you know, Seiko did a great job kind of dressing it up a little bit.
It's not a dive watch. I have no problem with it. I feel like I feel like we've had this conversation already. I don't mind an exhibition case back if it doesn't affect performance. I think it's good, you know. It's signed Seiko on the back. Nothing too fancy on the actual crystal. And it looks like, you know, you've got some basic orientation on the actual rotor. You know, it says 6R54, 24 jewels. So, yeah.
It's got some polishing. It's got some dressing.
It's nothing to write home about, but I don't think that it's bad either. Whatever. I think it's fine.
It's funny you say that, you know, it's not a dive watch. It's actually water resistant to 200 meters.
So it's better than my Speedy. That's what you're trying to say.
Oh, anything's better than that.
Oh, okay. Take it easy now. All right. All right. Very good. So I think I would go for the blue, Sanj, and you'd go for the black. Is that fair enough?
Yes. Okay. And I would go for the Speedy. I'm just joking with that to the listeners out there.
I, I know, Sanj. Oh, I know.
But I mean, as an everyday watch, this is a very compelling product.
It's nice. Yeah, it's definitely got an attractive package. The GMT definitely makes it, I think, a additional kind of dimension to the Alpinist, because, you know, in a way, for me, it's not a category of watch that I really care about, like mountaineering watches or even field watches. Like, you know, it's like
you were into field watches at one point. I think you were thinking about, correct me if I'm wrong, like a Tudor Ranger or something like that.
Very early, yeah, very early in our watch journeys, I did consider it. But, you know, to be honest, I've always felt like if you want a tough, durable watch, like, why don't you just get a dive watch? Like, I don't, you know, to me, it's like, you know, get a Submariner, get a Marine Master, get whatever. Like, why kind of compromise on water resistance? If anything, you might as well, because they're built tough as well. So, like, why not, right? So, it's just not a category that I really pay a lot of attention to, long story short. But being a GMT, you know, that kind of backdoors the Alpinist back into consideration. Yes. You know, is it enough? I don't know. I like it. I like the blue. You know, I think it's really tastefully done. So, yeah.
I only have one more complaint apart from the cathedral hands. I mean, that will be a forever complaint, but I wish it came in a strap and not like a leather strap. I think it being a field watch, strap? like a NATO strap.
Oh, like a NATO. Okay.
Yeah. So. Yeah. I think leather is a bit, how should I put it? Like it's not the right kind of strap for the kind of watch it is. I mean, you can wait outdoors. I mean, it makes it a bit dressier.
I think the whole like Japanese Alpinist scene is a bit different than what you have in mind, though. You know, like it's a little bit more casual. I mean, I have, you know, I am literally, you know, spitballing from things I've read and like things I've watched. I've obviously never been to Japan and I've never climbed Mount Fuji, so you know, don't take this too seriously. But I do think it's a little bit more of a different lifestyle than, you know, the people, I don't know, you know, free climbing something in, you know, something in the Himalayas. You know, it's a very, I think it's a more kind of Zen casual sort of thing that people do. So I don't know if it necessarily clashes, but listen, if you really want a NATO strap, you're talking about a $1,200 watch, you know, 20 bucks, get yourself a NATO strap. Let's not quibble over this.
Let's quibble. Tommy putting the hammer down.
I'm not losing sleep over a NATO strap, but yeah, I can see what you're saying. I mean, look, if you're going to be climbing, you know, would you, you know, want to wear a nice leather strap? I get what you're saying. Actually, interesting sidebar before we go to the next watch. I actually watched a video of a guy who runs a watch channel on YouTube, and he's invented a NATO strap that doesn't include a double pass.
Oh,
you know, like how like it, you have two layers of, or an extra layer of fabric on the bottom of your watch when you wear a NATO strap, so it's a little taller, where you've got the double, you know, it's like if one of the spring bars is lost, it's caught by that second fabric, right? So like it's the whole point of having a NATO strap, you know what I'm saying? So this guy designed a NATO strap without that extra protection. So basically it's a two-piece. It's basically a two-piece strap the way you wear it. Like it's looped. Like it's technically still looped. Like he hasn't cut the strap, but it's like looped and you lose that kind of protection. But the advantage is that it sits a little lower on your wrist. I'll share the video and we'll talk about it next episode. I kind of want to hear your thoughts on that. But just NATO strap related, you know, I have to find it again. So I thought it was interesting. I don't know. What do you think of this concept? I feel like it defeats the purpose of
NATO strap. I need to see it in
okay
visual representation before I even make any comment about it. But it's nice to hear that, you know, they're taking a new spin on a NATO strap. So
yeah, I do agree with the criticism that a NATO strap, when you wear it on a watch, it makes your watch sit up a little taller than you would want it to sit up, and it wobbles a bit. But I also think that if you get rid of that safety catch, you defeat the whole purpose of a NATO strap. But yeah, we'll talk about it next episode. Next watch, Sanj. This is a complication we've never talked about on the podcast. Are you ready for this?
Go for it.
Triple calendar.
Oh my goodness. All right.
We talked about it, right? So Worn and Wound covered the Mayan, M-A-E-N, Brooklyn 36 triple calendar. This is a very different kind of watch. I mean, looking at it, you're looking at basically a reverse panda, right? And you're thinking, okay, on the top of your head, you're thinking this is a chronograph. There's a date window at 6. This looks typically exactly like a chronograph. But if you look a bit closer, it's not a chronograph. The 3 o'clock subdial is basically the month, and the 9 o'clock subdial is the day of the week, and it's a triple calendar. Very, very unique, very much a complication that you know, I've never thought about nor shown any interest in. But now that I see it, I think it's kind of cool. It's inside. It's got the Miyota 9122 automatic caliber. So as I mentioned, date window at 6, day and month and subdials at 9 and 3, as we discussed. It's actually adjusted by a pusher hole. So there's no second crown or anything like that. It's an old school pusher hole. You need to use like a pen or a safety needle or something like that to reverse it. And if you look at the design, right? If you look at the actual dial, there's a slight sinking at the edge of the dial. So they kind of go for like a pie pan design.
Yeah, it's like a multi-layered dial. I mean, like the main, I guess, dial, which has the hour markers, it looks a little raised. And then you have the outer bit, which is in white. And that looks like it's a step down.
And the markers are applied. You can see there's a 3D, three-dimensional sort of look to them. And they're actually faceted. So like you can actually see like the, and you know, if you look very closely at the 3 and 9, the facet clip at the end of that marker is actually retained next to those subdials, which I think is really cool. They've really done a really tasteful job of trying to keep things as symmetrical and clean as possible. And I do love the white kind of outer track there. It's a really attractive watch. It comes on a Jubilee bracelet. Very clean design. 36.
Yeah, it's got that like interplay of black and white, like the Bulova Oceanographer GMT.
Yeah, I could see that. Yeah, I could see that. And that Jubilee bracelet's really, really kind of tastefully picked. It reminds me so much, even though it's a modern watch, right? It reminds me so much of like a really old, like 1960s tool watch. It has that feel to it.
Right. Yeah. I can see that.
And I don't know what it is, right? Maybe it's the choice of the hands. Maybe it's the choice of the colors, but it's very tastefully done. I really love this design. I think it's really attractive. I have no interest in a triple calendar, but the rest of the package is so well put together. It's almost like, you know, I can't look away. It's really, really, really attractive.
I mean, if you really do wear like a watch like this every day, a triple calendar does make sense.
It's useful. It's definitely useful.
It's totally useful.
You know, it gives you the month, day, and time. So what else do you need? I mean, is it the most exciting? Do I need to know what month it is? I feel like, you know, I'm not going to have amnesia, you know?
No, but I mean, you know, a quick glance of what day it is will be nice.
Day? I feel like I know what day it is. The only thing I need is the date.
Do you really know what day it is?
It's Sunday. I got that far. But the date, I feel, is
the first few weeks. The first few weeks of parenthood. Did you know what day it was?
I had no idea. It was
exactly. Absolute, this would help you.
Absolute blur. I think it's really attractive.
It's a nice watch. And this is really, by, is this like a micro?
So it's a small brand. It's an independent brand. They're a Swedish brand with a Dutch name, which I think is really interesting. But quick question. The whole package you see, what do you think it costs?
Well, I already know the cost, but.
Okay, so $762 for.
That's not bad at all.
It's really, really impressive. Like
it is. You got to give credit where it's due. And this is a very nice watch. I have no complaints. I can't even like fault anything, to be honest.
It almost feels like it's like a like an old Datejust or something like that. I mean,
what I would wear if I was back in the 60s as an engineer.
Yeah, it's a very clean design. And it's actually making me look a little bit harder at Maine as a whole, because this is so nice. Like, I'm actually just like looking at their GMT lineup on the website. They have like a really nice 38 millimeter GMT. Really nice, Sanj. We should cover these guys. So I'm a fan. I'm a fan of what these guys are doing.
I mean, just looking at the first glance, the way they're executed the watch, it's really well done.
Really, really well done. Yeah, it's really tastefully done. That the hand choice is really, really nice. Even the little loom plots, the kind of fautina kind of cream coloring.
Oh, the little pips.
Pips. Yeah, it's so well done. It's so clean.
The crystal is domed as well. It like kind of pops out like a 60s style.
I'm really impressed. I'm really impressed. I think this is really something special. And to do all that for
could be like an underdog hit for the year, probably, right?
What's that?
This could be the underdog hit of the year.
I really think so. I mean, I don't think anybody gets. I mean, look, like I said, triple calendar. You know, it's hard to get me excited about it. It's just not a complication I think a lot about. But it looks so attractive and it's done so well. You know, and I also think at 36 millimeters, it could even be a switch hitter for men and women. It's really, really an attractive watch. Really, really nice.
This is the first 36 millimeter watch you're like raving.
You know, there's a certain part of me who's like getting older, and I'm like, you know what? Like a simple Rolex Datejust wouldn't be the worst
thing.
Crash
it to death.
What's that?
I was saying, we'll have to edit something out here. Something got like broken up a bit.
Oh, okay.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. Yeah.
Don't worry. Yeah. So I'll just do a quick three count. 3, 2, 1, go. So this is 36 millimeters.
Yeah.
This is might be like the one 36 millimeter watch you're raving about.
I do think it's really nicely sized. And I, you know, as I get older, I think about like, you know, like old school, the Tony Soprano Datejust or
I have an Omega Seamaster that's 36 millimeters, and yet you bash it to the ground.
I can't believe it.
Cool boy wrists.
Coming around to that size. Yeah.
How the tables have turned. What has the world come to?
What's the world coming to? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, I think it's done really well. Actually, looking at the main website, the reverse panda is just one of multiple kind of color variations. They have like a panda with cream. There's also just an all black. There's a black with kind of gray subdials. There's a green actually with darker black subdials, and there's like a kind of copper or bronze. So there's a lot of interesting variations on this. I still would pick the reverse panda, but. Still, I'm a huge fan of what these guys are doing.
It's interesting that, you know,
really interesting.
Yeah, it's really well done, and nothing against like the naming of the watch or anything, but it's just interesting that a Swedish watch company has a Dutch name but naming their models with iconic New York places.
I know. Yeah, it's kind of all over the place branding wise. I don't know what to make of that. But look, you know, the execution is good. The execution is good. I think what they're doing, it makes a lot of sense. So, yeah, good on you guys.
Yeah,
good
we should cover these guys a little bit more. Get into the world of this brand and see what they have to offer.
And look, it's the first triple calendar for the podcast. So that's something. That's something. All right, Sanj.
We're going to talk about moon phases next episode. That's what.
No, I was going to say the next watch is a brand that you hold very close to your heart. So
yes, it's back, baby. It's back.
That's right. We're back. Backstreet's back.
Back from the grave. So we are talking about the Fortis N42 Novanaut.
Wow. Okay. For podcast listeners, you actually own a Fortis.
Yes, I own the B-42 Cosmonaut Chronograph. Not the OG one, but then I think they call it like the second generation or so.
Okay, the OG one is the steel Lemania 5100.
The old, yes.
Correct.
Yes, okay. It's the old one. And this is the Bajou 7750. A bit bigger, a bit more heftier, and an incredible watch. It's one of my everyday watches. I pick it up and I put it on. It's been through everything.
I wouldn't say you can pick it up, but yeah, sure. You put it on.
I mean, what happens is I get my crane that I assembled and then I put it on my wrist with, you know, it's got like, I whenever I put the Fortis, it's kind of like, you know, how Iron Man gears up. He has these robots.
Yeah.
I just have one for the watch.
it's a beautiful watch. It does to me wear a little bit big, but it's a beautiful watch. But
I mean, I wouldn't call it beautiful. I just think it's a well-proportioned, very tool-tastic watch.
It's for tools, definitely. So tell us about the N42.
So the N42 is more or less the next gen of the series. I'm pretty sure why they had to rename it to the N42 and not like the Cosmonaut Chronograph, given the current geopolitical reasons. That's my guess.
So wait, but it's no longer Cosmonauts? It's a Finnish?
No, it's the Novonaut. That's what they're calling it.
Interesting. Okay.
So they're taking the essentially a relook at what they could do to make the B-42 a bit more tool-tastic, essentially. You know, a bit more, useful in the field, per se.
You said it, not me. Yeah, go on.
So the case is essentially 42 millimeters, but it's a little bit thinner. It's now 15 millimeters. I think the B-42 is like 15.6 or 15.5. So I'll take any cut in the thickness for that speaking.
Okay, got it.
The bezel is now bi-directional and is ceramic with lume, I believe.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So the B-42, I'm wearing it right now. It's aluminum bezel insert and there's no lume except for the, let's say, the quote unquote 12 o'clock, which is an inverted triangle with the lume pip.
Okay. Gotcha.
And the dial has been upgraded to have a bit more detail. And weirdly, it has some interesting markers, such as the, like, every half hour, there's a indication of the time. Not sure exactly what you can use that for, but there is some reasoning why it's there.
Every half hour, there's an indication of the time.
Yeah, so if you look at 1 o'clock, you know, you have a big numeral there, and then you have a 2 o'clock, but in between there's a 1.5.
Oh, I see. Wow. Okay. Yeah. Interesting. What is the point of that?
I have no clue.
And another question I had was at the running subdial at 9, the running second subdial, there's an orange marker at like the 47th second.
That is interesting. I have not even taken a look at that at all.
So I what does that mean? So
how did you even count orange?
I'm having a bit of a Rain Man moment here. It just popped out of me.
Yeah, that is so bizarre.
Yeah, there's got to be a reason for it, but interesting. Yeah. Yeah, I don't understand why they do that 1.5, 2.5. That seems needlessly cluttering the dial, but okay.
I mean, it is what it is. I mean, there's probably a reason that I have not picked it up yet, but the movement is now, it's 7750 base. They call it the work caliber 15.
Okay.
And it's the same as the Fortis Stratoliner. The other kind of like space watch, the one we talked about it a few episodes ago. It's a bit more.
I really like that release. That is a really nice release.
Yeah, that's a very like interesting case layout.
It's very clean. Yeah.
Very clean. And it's been upgraded with 60 hours power reserve. That's one complaint I have with my watch. It's like 42 hours. I mean, I don't wear it every day, but when I do, I have to like wind up the watch.
Interesting. Okay.
And it's going to come in different flavors as well. So you have kind of like the first edition. It's, and this is limited to 100 pieces. And it's like a Sunray Burst Black Dial with a bit more orange detail at the R indices. You have the Legacy, which is like the classic Black Dial, like what I have.
Yeah.
And then new is the Cobalt Blue, which is a blue dial with an
exhibition. Oh, I like the Cobalt Blue. Nice.
It's got an exhibition case back. I don't know, you know, like how you feel about that.
Yeah.
But the cool thing with the exhibition case, I mean, with the Cobalt Blue is that it's got the day and date complication in a different, let's say, color scheme. So it's like white background and black or like orange text. So pretty interesting upgrades. I think the one I am pretty excited to see is that the bezel got upgraded, and having that kind of ceramic and lubed kind of adds a bit more legibility in dark conditions. So
the exhibition case back has a little like spaceship in the back, like it's like a,
yeah, it's got a little rocket spaceship in the back. Yeah,
interesting. Okay,
it's just a little fun.
Don't have fun.
Don't have
just
fun.
Kidding. Just kidding.
Meanwhile, Omega can make like the Snoopy. And yeah, what's wrong with Snoopy? There's nothing wrong with Snoopy. Actually, I like that one too.
No, there you go. No, I like this a lot, Sanj. I think this is really attractive. I do think it's a lot busier than your version, like even more so. And I'm not sure how I feel about that.
I'm just comparing the watch. So they cleaned up in other ways too. The one thing they removed was the tachymeter at like the circumference around the dial. I think they call it the rehawk. They added a bit more fine marker indices and to track the time, which I think makes sense because like you're not gonna, you know, if you're in space, you really don't care if you're traveling at 400 kilometers an hour, because you're traveling at 400,000 kilometers an hour, you know?
Yeah, the tachymeter is fairly useless.
Yeah.
Yeah, it just looks good. But interesting. Okay.
And, you know, like, I think the half hour indices is a little bit busy, but it's not too bad now that I look at it.
You do get used to it. It's a lot smaller, right? So it's not like, it's not the same size. Yeah, no, I think it's kind of cool. I do think that they cut down the text as well. It just says Fortis Novanaut, whereas your version said Fortis Chronograph Automatic. Yeah, it's interesting. To be honest, I'm not sure I would pick the new one. I kind of like your version. I think as well. I think really would come down to like fit and size more than anything else.
I'll need to see the new version just to see how it goes with the, you know, compared to the one I have.
Right. I mean, I think they know that size is an issue, you know, and they've taken some steps to make it a little bit slimmer. So
yeah, no, this is a, you know, a heavy duty tool watch.
Yeah,
whether it goes back in space, who knows.
Yeah, well, we'll see. Yeah, I don't know the future of that relationship with Roscosmos, but interesting. I do think it's kind of unfortunate to rename the model because it's historically the Cosmonaut Chronograph. I think, you know, for 30 plus years, that's what they wear, you know, but I guess they felt like they had to do it. But no, I think this is a compelling release. This is a really compelling release. I really like it. Yeah.
So from the price point of view, the Legacy Steel is about €4,950.
Okay.
The blue... Cobalt Blue is $4,750, and that comes in a rubber strap, but you can get a steel one for a little bit more, $5,100. Okay. And then the first edition is €5,200.
The first edition?
Yeah, it's the limited edition. It's only 100 pieces. I would just go for the Legacy for myself.
What's different about the first edition?
It's got a sunburst dial and a bit more orange add-ons to...
Oh, there's like orange markers like every 5 minutes. It's like there's a countdown. I see. There's like a countdown track on the inside that's in orange. Okay, it's a little extra pop, basically. Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. All right. I think this is, you know, I think this is a useful update to the line. You know, I think it comes down to like kind of like what do you think about the ceramic bezel, fit and finish, sizing. That's really the big headline stuff, I guess. And the movement.
Yes. I mean, it's an upgrade for sure.
It's an upgrade. All right. Very good, Cinch. I think that wraps up basically new releases that we want to talk about. Complicated watches. Do you have a watch of buying for our holiday shoppers out there? It is the Christmas season.
It is the Christmas season, and prepare to be in the Seiko spirit, because on Joma Shop, they are selling the Seiko 5 GMT. The one I'm linking to is the blue dial, the black and blue, kind of like the Seiko 5 Batman.
Okay, cool.
For $369.
That is not bad. That is not bad for a brand new take of that watch. Very cool. Okay. And we kind of like the Seiko 5 GMT, right? I mean, we give it kind of a positive.
Yeah. There's nothing. Yeah, no. It's a great entry-level GMT watch. I mean,
No harm in it.
I mean, obviously, we have to check the fit and finish of it, you know, because this is an entry-level mechanical watch.
Yeah.
And, you know, Seiko at these price points are known for having a little bit of quality issues.
Some like QC issues. Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, this is, you know, like a Seiko interpretation of like the Rolex Batman or the Batgirl.
Yeah, I think this is like the Seiko 5 fun way to kind of get that look. You know, yeah, sure. No harm in it. I like it, Cinch.
So, yeah, I mean, great price. You can't go wrong.
Can't go wrong. Yeah, that's a pretty good price for brand new. That's really something. I do want to remind people that Joma Shop has its own warranty. So it's, you know, you don't get a Seiko warranty. You get basically a Joma Shop warranty. But from all the feedback I've heard, they're pretty good about, you know, if there's any issues, you can return it back to them and they'll send you another one.
Right.
And I've bought stuff from Joma Shop and I've never had any issues with them. So, you know, I know everybody kind of poo-poos the gray market, but hey, you know.
I haven't had any issues myself too.
Yeah, times are tough, you know, and you know, they do a pretty good job, so there's no harm in it as far as that.
Yeah, and they have a nice selection of watches. I mean, you can't go wrong.
They have a huge selection. I mean, they carry Rolex, they carry Omega, they carry Seiko, they carry everything. So, you know, they're doing something right. Yeah. So, all right, Cinch, streaming gold.
All right, streaming gold. So I think you're up first, Tommy.
All right. So I have a video by ID Guy. It's industrial design. It's like a watch kind of watch channel run by like an industrial designer. Are you familiar with this? ID?
No, not at all.
Yeah, it's pretty good. You should check it out. He's got some really good insights as far as design and like, you know, basically design language in watches. And this video is what happened to the Omega Speedmaster Planet Ocean. And what he means by what happened is that, you know, he traces each generation of the Seamaster Planet Ocean from the Casino Royale Planet Ocean forward. And if you look at each new release, the Planet Ocean gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. You know, it gets taller and fatter and heavier. And I agree with him. You know, I think a lot of people who are into the Planet Ocean kind of see that early Daniel Craig Planet Ocean as the ideal Planet Ocean to get. I've looked and kept an eye on these watches for a while because I, you know, back in my mind, I'm like, I'd love to have a Planet Ocean in the collection. And the more I look, like, I think like the newer ones are very technically capable, like no, you know, not going to argue there. But I think the most attractive Planet Oceans are those early ones that Craig wore. You know, I'm talking Casino Royale, like that watch was awesome. Even the Quantum of Solace watch, I think, was really, really attractive. But, you know, it over the years, it just got bigger and bigger and bigger and kind of lost that Seamaster identity. So it's a very interesting video. It's, you know, a deep dive just into that line and kind of, you know, each iteration and like kind of where it's going. So, yeah, I don't know. Do you feel the same way, Sanj, or what? Is it just,
you know what? I never really thought about it too much. I actually don't mind the current Planet Ocean. As a matter of fact, I rather take the current Planet Ocean over the Seamaster Professional series or the line. I'm just not a fan of the current iteration of the Seamaster Pro.
I understand. I'm not a huge Seamaster guy at this stage either. I don't like the skeletonized hands. That's just, for me, kind of a deal breaker. You're talking about the Seamaster 300, right?
Yeah, yeah. The one with the skeletonized hands, the yeah. wavy dial, it's which I actually don't familiar. Mind the wavy thing too much. I mean, it's a nice little design, but the whole look of the watch, it just doesn't resonate with me. The Planet Ocean resonates way more with me.
Yeah, take a look at the Planet Ocean Casino Royale. Because if you look at the Planet Ocean Casino Royale, you're basically looking at a 1960s era Seamaster that's been beefed up. It's very clean.
Yes.
What I'm saying? It's got the twisted lugs. It's got the same kind of digits on the dial. There's very little use of color on it at all. It's really, really attractive. And I think the Quantum of Solace edition is what I'm looking at right now, but the Casino Royale and Quantum of Solace, like that era is a really nice Planet Ocean. That's kind of what I would go for.
Yeah, I think part of the reason I'm just doing a comparison of the two right now, like the Casino Royale Planet Ocean, the hour markers, the indices and everything is a little bit slimmer than that of the current like product. Like it looks a bit more chunkier and beefier. And the hour and minute hands look way different. Again, slimmer with the older version.
Yeah, yeah. I also think that the case design was much closer to those Twisted Lugs, Speedmaster, Seamaster design than they are now. I think they've kind of moved a little bit past that. Something to think about. There are a lot of people who are fans of the Planet Ocean now, so I don't want to, poo-poo it. Obviously, even the Planet Ocean now is supposed to evoke that Seamaster look. I just think that the dimensions of it, I agree with this guy, are a little bit out of control. So I think Omega really needs to hit the pause button on bigger and kind of decide what it wants to do.
Yeah, the case thickness is 16 millimeters. Good Lord.
It's nuts. It's like you can't wear this thing, and it's like you compare it to the 2005, 2006 Planet Oceans and like they're really, really perfectly sized. He was talking about how people on like Omega forums are like trying to source the old Planet Oceans and not even looking at the new ones, which is really pretty damning, to Omega, that people are more interested in your, 15 or 20 year old watch than really what you're selling right now. So I don't know. I hope they fix it, but yeah, there's limits to how big you can really make this thing. And it's just getting a bit out of control.
Right.
All right, Sam. That's my rant about the Planet Ocean.
We just made a rant about the Planet Ocean, but that's okay. It's worth the discussion.
Yeah. Check out the video. Let me know what you guys think. If you agree with the guy, I tend to agree. I think he's got a really good point.
All right. So the one I'm going to talk about is from the channel Real Engineering, which is an amazing channel. And they talk about the insane engineering of the F-16 and how the kind of like the U.S. Air Force or the military kind of took a reset into airplane design, given the effects of the Vietnam War with the F-4 Phantom and what they thought they needed to go to make a step forward. One of the things was maneuverability, which was the F-4 was limited to. And yeah, they made something a bit smaller or a lot smaller than the F-4 and something a bit of like a race car in a sense that this thing can turn on a dime. Yep. So anyway, it talks about the development of the F-16 and it also includes a pilot who has flown the F-16 and trains other pilots. And he talks about this as well. A really good in-depth overview as to the design philosophy of the airplane. So
it's not my favorite aircraft, but I will check it out.
It's a very capable aircraft. I mean, it's like one would think that, you know, this little thing, you know, may not be able to do much, but it's, they've really made some huge upgrades. And this is one of the few fighter jets that's been sold to a lot of nations. It may even be the most sold type of fighter jet.
It's very, yeah, it's sold to a lot of customers. I mean, basically the F-16 was what the F-5 was, you know, the next generation of the F-5, kind of like a cheap, you know, cheap fighter that you could produce at home and make up numbers for, you know, the Air Force, and you could also sell to export customers. You know, it wasn't the supreme, you know, dogfighter that the F-15 was. It wasn't a carrier aircraft. It was basically, you know, an aircraft that was relatively expensive, quite capable, and you could build a lot of them, you know, when you need it.
And still really fast too. I think it's faster than the F-35.
Yeah, it may be. Actually, I think you sent me this video on Instagram about, or maybe it was your brother actually sent. She was saying that, you know, the F-16 could actually out dogfight an F-35, but the problem is the F-35 would detect the F-16. You know, way before the F-16 could pick up the F-35. So you know, the F-16 would basically have to dodge two missiles before it could even get close to the F-35. So
exactly.
That's kind of the drawback. Yeah. You know?
So, yeah. That's why they didn't need to make the F-35 so, like, you know, Mach 2 capability or anything, because it's so advanced with its suite of electronics and technology that it can detect. Yeah, so far away and take out the threat. So
right. So it's a different kind of fighting. But yeah, no, I'll check it out. That's a really interesting video. The F-16 is kind of underloved, including by me. But you know, it's an
important. What is your fighter, Tommy?
My favorite? I mean, I love the F-14, Sanj. You know, I'm an old school '80s guy. You know,
you're an old school '80s guy. I thought it was the Spitfire.
I'm talking jet aircraft. What was your pick?
Good question. I love the F-14 really, growing up. You know, Top Gun, obviously, but
yeah.
I mean,
F-15 is kind of like a super aircraft. Like that's the ultimate fighter plane. You know.
Oh, the F-15 definitely. I mean, F-15. It is the ultimate. Like it's like a hot rod.
The flying tennis court. Yeah, I mean, it's the only fighter jet that shot down a satellite. It has a perfect air-to-air record, even now, like some 40, 50 years later.
And they just released the latest iteration for the Air Force, the F-15EX.
That's right. Yeah. So it's pretty crazy that a design that was built, you know, right after Vietnam is still going strong, if not still being, you know, upgraded and still being really desirable. So,
I mean, you have the B-52. Which is going to be 100 years old when it's like done its life, over 100 years, right? I mean,
The B-52 is like a dump truck, though, Sanj. I mean, you're not contesting airspace with the B-52. You
know? True.
Contesting airspace, yeah.
But what always bogs me and always, like, you know, surprises me, not boggles me, is the B-1 bomber has a higher cargo capability than the B-52.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
It's a huge plane. Have you ever seen one?
I've never seen one, no.
Oh, it's big.
I've seen one flying in a flyby. I've actually never been up close, so I don't know the scale. I didn't realize it was that big.
Oh, it's huge. You'd be surprised. Like it looks like it's a small aircraft. Oh, I wouldn't say small, but smaller than the B-52. But if you in real life, especially with the wings and all of that, it's one beast, one big beast.
Yeah. Well, apparently they're making a new B what, the
21
B-21. Yeah. Right. Okay.
Yeah, that's the B-2 replacement essentially.
Yeah. Well, you know, these contractors got to get paid, Sanj. We got to replace them. You know. So.
Yeah, you can't keep.
Never mind whether you need them or not.
You got to push the envelope.
Every 20 years, yeah, you got to push the envelope. All right, very cool. I'll have to check that out. Sanj, you got something else for Streaming Gold?
I do, one more, and it's a channel called Animagraphs. So okay. It's a gentleman named Jake O'Neill, and he makes highly detailed 3D models of, let's say, transportation objects mostly. And he goes through it, and you know, it varies from like an 18th century warship to that of like the modern jet aircraft. And some of them are really interesting because not only does he model them, he talks about how they function as well. So one of the ones I actually kind of enjoyed was the steam locomotive, the big boy.
Yeah.
That one was very cool to see, at least to me.
Nice.
So highly recommend. I mean, there's even one, you know, like such as a World War II submarine. A little bit on the random side of what he covers, but, you know, pretty geeky, pretty nerdy, and a lot of detail. So something that, you know, modeling something like this takes a long time. So big kudos.
Pretty interesting. Yeah, there's actually another channel called AI Telly. They do the same thing on YouTube, modeling like fighter jets and tanks and stuff like that. So it's kind of interesting. Very cool. I'll have to check it out, Sanj.
All right. I guess.
All right. So I think that's all we had for this episode. Yeah. Thanks again for joining us for another episode of the Land Jam podcast. Please like and subscribe. Give us an iTunes review. Really helps the podcast, really gets us out there. Also follow us on Instagram and Twitter. A lot of daily content. Until next time. Thank you.